Well, hello there, ladies and gentlemen. The MSS crew is back and on the attack, and thanking you for joining us here in the Fred Bertelsen Memorial Old Time Radio Room of RadioOutOfThePast.org. Today's date is Saturday, June 18th, 2016, and this is your MSS host, once again assisting with bringing to you yet another exciting and super exhilarating internet broadcast of Michael's Saturday Night Surprise. Why don't you allow me to introduce the presenter for tonight's program? Just so happens to be one of those Canadian guys, you know, real nice and Canada dry, and straight out of the badlands of Canada, Mad Max Crawford. Yep. He's back again, and he's put together a little something special for you all here tonight. Without any further delays, I would just ask if everyone could please sit back, grab your favorite drinks and snacks, and enjoy the program. Mad Max, the microphone is yours.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Maxwell, here to welcome you to Michael's Saturday Surprise for Saturday, June the 18th, 2016. What is today's subject? I have a subject in mind, but you're not going to find out that easily. Here's a hint. Before you hear a radio show, we're going to let you hear Paul Harvey tell you the rest of the story. This comes from an episode, it's called Episode 200, and it will not tell you the title, or you'll know what the program's about right away. Here it is, Paul Harvey, the rest of the story.
Now, the rest of the story. Mary Stillwell was 16. Old enough to be dating, perhaps, and yet to Mary's father, it seemed this young man, Tommy, was becoming all too serious all too quickly. They had met at work. In the beginning, Mary would come home each day to report how Tommy had been staring at her, or standing much too close, or making forward comments. "What do you think of me?" he sometimes asked. "Do you like me?" Well, as the weeks went by, Mary did begin to like Tommy. Quite a lot, in fact. One day he got up the nerve to ask her out. They went to the theater and had a good time. Then Tommy began calling on Mary at home. Her parents kept a watchful eye on their courtship. The young couple were made to sit in the parlor and converse politely. Not about personal matters, of course, but rather about their work or their weather, and all with Mary's mother or father sitting nearby, monitoring each word. And that would probably have been the extent of the young couple's relationship had Tommy not devised a plan. Tommy knew Morse code. So each morning when he met Mary at work, and each evening before he left, he taught her a new letter of the alphabet in Morse code. And before long, the dots and dashes had aligned and combined in Mary's mind to comprise a language of pulses which she could share with Tommy privately. That is, whenever he visited her home, and the two were sitting in the parlor, while eavesdropping parents heard only idle, inconsequential talk, Tommy, holding a coin, a silver quarter, in fact, would tap out what he really meant to say in the palm of Mary's hand. And then he would pass the coin to Mary, and she would do the same. And thus did they converse in perfect secrecy. Then one evening in Mary's parlor, as openly the two discussed a show playing at Taylor and Sylvester's Music Hall, Tommy tapped out in Mary's hand, "I have been thinking of you all the time. Would you marry me?" And Mary Stillwell, her large, soft eyes moist with tears, took the coin from Tommy's hand and responded in Morse code, "That would make me very happy." And so once upon a time did a young love take root and blossom in the arid earth of parental scrutiny, culminating in a silent entreaty and the answer yes and the sound of wedding bells echoing through the snowy hills one Christmas day in 1871. And all because a determined and resourceful young suitor discovered a means of achieving the apparently impossible public privacy. All through their marriage on occasion, he and Mary continued to communicate in Morse code. And after Tom's hearing had failed to the point that he could no longer understand the dialogue in a stage play, Mary, placing her hand on his knee in the dark and tapping with her finger, would relate everything the actor said. More than 100 years later, the world prefers to honor the accomplishments of Mary's husband in order of their significance to the common good. But now, you have learned of the invention that meant the most to him, his own invention that made possible the all-important silent entreaty of Thomas Alva Edison. Because now you know the rest of the story.
Hi, everybody. This is Max, and I'm back after our short 4-minute tale from Paul Harvey. Have you figured out yet the subject of tonight's old-time radio shows? It's Thomas Edison, my friends, the man that had invented the light bulb and has innovated the recording industry a trillion times over, in my humble opinion. All right, let's start with American history through the eyes of radio from the Old Time Radio Researchers Group. Here is the Cavalcade of America, 1898, Thomas Edison.
The Cavalcade of America, presented by DuPont. Every American knows something of the life and works of Thomas Alva Edison. He is properly called the complete genius. Before the dawn of the present century, he had established himself as an outstanding inventor of all time. To Mr. Edison, one invention was a challenge which led to others. As an example, take the incandescent lamp or electric bulb. After he had developed it, he went ahead with other developments, the dynamo, the method of wiring, the electric meter, and the junction box that made the whole system function as a commercial actuality. He invented the stock exchange ticker. Then he perfected a telegraph relay, which would accept 3,000 words per minute, a speed so fast that he had to develop both a paper and an ink, which would operate at that rate. He was constantly at work, seeking to develop new ideas and improve upon old ones. He was inspired by the same creative urge that inspires research chemists, men who are striving to fulfill the DuPont pledge, better things for better living through chemistry. As an overture, Don Voorhees and the DuPont Cavalcade Orchestra bring you a special musical setting of Irving Berlin's popular Crinoline Days from the Music Box Review.
Thank you.
DuPont cavalcade moves forward. This evening, the DuPont cavalcade does not seek to retell the facts you already know about Edison the inventor, but rather to relate several little-known episodes in the life of Edison the man. The material used is mostly new and unrecorded. Much of it has been gathered by personal interviews with people who worked with Mr. Edison. In 1898, Edison, 51 years old, was perfecting a process to reduce low-grade iron ore on a scale never before attempted. He had built a new type of ore reduction plant in the Ogden Mountains of New Jersey, not far from his manufacturing plant in West Orange. The ore reduction plant was in production and ready to begin operating at full capacity. One afternoon, the plant manager, Walter S. Mallory, bursts into Edison's private office in West Orange.
Mr. Edison? Mr. Edison?
Confound it, Mallory. You know I don't like to be interrupted.
Yeah, but this is important.
Well, what is it?
About the ore reduction plant.
Nothing's happened to it?
No, it's running all right, but have you much of your own money tied up in it?
Nearly everything I've got.
Well, I guess neither of us will get rich on it now.
Why not? What's wrong?
Well, I hate to tell you, but I can't put it off.
Well, spit it out, man. What is it?
News from the West. A huge deposit of high-grade iron ore has just been discovered.
Where?
In the Mesabi Range in Minnesota, lying right on the surface. Of course, it isn't as near the eastern smelters as our plant is. We can ship our product cheaper. Perhaps we can keep right on producing.
No, we couldn't meet that price. We're through.
What are we going to do?
Shut down at once.
But all our equipment, the giant rollers, the machinery...
We'll have to find some other way of using them. Something that needs crushing and milling. Cement.
But we don't know anything about cement.
We will, Mallory. Get me every book you can find on it. I'll study the subject while you wind up the affairs of the ore reduction plant.
I don't see why you're so cheerful, sir.
Why shouldn't I be cheerful? I'm out of the manufacturing business and back to inventing again.
But I thought you had much of your money tied up in the ore reduction plant. Why, it must have cost nearly $3 million.
It did.
A fortune.
Yes, but Mallory...
Yes?
We had a lot of fun while it lasted. And there's still the cement business.
Edison was never discouraged. Obstacles that would have appalled an ordinary man only stimulated him to greater effort. His study of the Portland cement business convinced him that the method then used in the industry was inefficient and wasteful. Too much of the heat used in burning the lime went up the chimney. Edison announced that he would use a kiln nearly twice as long as the one in general use. Impossible, cried all the experts. But he set up an experimental plant and put Mallory in charge of it. The first results were very disappointing. One hot summer day, Mallory calls at Edison's office.
You wanted to see me, Mr. Edison?
Yes, I did. Look here, Mallory. You know anything about alkalis as electric agents?
I know. And what's that got to do with making Portland cement?
Nothing. I'm trying to make a storage battery.
With that junk you've got there?
It isn't junk. It's experimental apparatus.
Looks like a lot of dirty tumblers to me.
They're full of my new alkali solution. They're the last tumblers I've got in the place. This is the last of a long series of experiments in a hunt for an iron derivative. Wait till I connect these metal poles with an electric current. There.
Well, nothing happened.
Yes, I realize that, Mallory, but I've learned something.
You've learned something?
Yes. I've found 10,000 things that won't work. I've just discovered another one.
Look out.
Oh!
Oh, that's too bad, Mr. Edison. They all fell and broke. What'll you do now?
Well, I guess the next thing to do is to buy some more tumblers.
Pardon me, sir, but did you ask me to come here from the cement plant on a scorching hot day just to show me this?
No. I want you to see the report of the results you're getting in the cement plant.
Well, I've seen it. I made out the report myself. It's not bad, is it?
Not bad, it's rotten.
Well, just because your kiln is 2.5 times as long as the old kind, there's no reason to think you can get 5 times as much cement out of it.
I expect 5 times as much. Your report shows only 500 barrels a day.
500 a day now? And that's a miracle.
It's nothing. Isn't even a decent start. That long kiln ought to be put out 1,000 barrels a day.
Why, that's impossible.
If that's your attitude, no wonder you don't get results. You're licked before you start.
Now, look here, Mr. Edison. I've sweat and bled over that blasted kiln for weeks. And that's the best I can do.
Well, it isn't good enough.
And if you think there's 1,000 barrels of cement a day in that kiln, maybe you can get it out yourself. I can.
We'll see about that. I'll answer it. Hello? Yes? He's right here. See you, Mallory.
Oh, thanks. Hello? Yes? What? Oh, she is. I see. Yes. Yes. Goodbye.
What's the matter, Mallory?
My little girl, Charlotte. She's worse.
Well, what's wrong?
Necrosis has set in, and the kneecaps she hurt. The doctor said this terrific heat is making it worse. Temperature in her room is 97. I'm afraid there's nothing we can do but pray heaven she lives through this heat wave.
We must end the heat wave.
The weather reports there'll be several days of it.
Oh, hang the weather reports. You don't have to worry about the weather in the whole state of New Jersey. All we care about is the weather in your daughter's room.
Well, I guess that's my worry, sir. You have troubles enough of your own. Now, about that cement kiln, if you really think that...
No, never mind that. There's another invention I'd make right away.
Well, then, if you don't mind, Mr. Edison, I'd like to go home.
Of course. I'd like to go with you.
You're very kind, Mr. Edison, but I don't want to take you from important work, sir.
The important work I've got to do right now is something for your little girl.
I don't understand.
Come over here to the drawing board. Hey there, Professor.
Yes, Mr. Edison?
Ought to be clean paper on my drawing board.
Oh, I put some there an hour ago, sir. I can't imagine what's become of it.
I can. It's become a cement plant.
Oh, I'll get some clean paper right away, sir.
Does it still amuse you to be your own draftsman, Mr. Edison?
What's amusement got to do with it? It saves time. Instead of telling a man, I'd rather show him my ideas on paper. Anyway, it gives my hands something to do while I'm thinking. I never waste time making finished drawings. I just make sketches.
How do you find draftsmen who can translate them?
I don't find them. They find me.
Here's a paper, sir.
Good. Now file these sheets I've used under cement.
Under cement? Oh, yes, cement. In the file, you mean. Right away, sir.
Now, Mallory, let's take a quick look at what's in my mind. We've got to change the weather. In that room where your daughter Charlotte is. And let's see now. Yes. We ought to start like this.
Well,
now, don't say anything. Just watch.
Edison completed his sketches on the drawing board. Then he sent Mallory to the carpenter shop with the drawings, and with special orders that all other work should be dropped until the machine he had sketched was finished. An hour later, Mallory and one of the carpenters loaded a strange-looking wooden box on an automobile and started for Mallory's house. Outside Charlotte's hot, stuffy room, Mrs. Mallory meets her husband.
Walter, won't you stop that noise? Charlotte is... Oh, Walter, why didn't you come right away when I telephoned you?
Well, I couldn't, dear. You see, Mr. Edison...
Mr. Edison. He's always wanting you to do something.
Now, wait, dear. Mr. Edison has just made this for Charlotte and for us.
That big wooden box. But, Walter, we can't have that in Charlotte's room. Oh, what's the use of it? She's sick, Walter. The heat.
I know, dear. But just let us bring it in and install it.
Install it? What do you mean?
Open the door to Charlotte's room, dear. I'll show you. If it works.
If it works? Oh, Walter. Our little girl is worse. She's thinking, and you want to experiment.
Yes, dear, but I think it will help. Now, if you'll just trust in me and open the door.
Very well.
Please, Mrs. Mallory, the room must be quiet.
But Mr. Mallory is here. It was an idea of Mr. Edison.
I don't know what the doctor would say, I'm sure.
Now, hold the door wide open, nurse, please. I think we can just get through with this box.
Pardon me, Mr. Mallory. I don't think the doctor would like you to bring that thing into the room.
It's all right, nurse. Now, stand aside while we carry the box over to the window, please.
Walter, Do you have to do this?
Yes, dear, I do. I have a feeling that Mr. Edison has solved our problem.
Oh, but Walter, our problem is Charlotte.
I realize that, my dear. Put it down easy now, Simmons.
Yes, sir.
No noise, please.
Yes, Miss Riley.
There. There, Scott. Now, help me fix those wooden legs for the box.
Mr. Mallory, please. That big box just out the windowsill there, it shuts off the air from the windowsill, what air there is.
Yes, nurse, that's what it's meant to do.
But, Mr. Mallory, that's the whole trouble. Trying to let Charlotte have as much air as we can.
Yes, nurse. Now, if you'll just stand back, please. You got that other leg fixed yet, Simon?
Oh, wait, now. Hold it. Yes, there it is. The box is steady now, but I'll have to drive in a few nails to make sure the whole thing's firm.
Oh, you can't do that. Not in this room. The doctor said Charlotte must be protected from noise. Oh, Walter, don't let him do it, please.
My dear, you must let us go ahead with this thing. It may help Charlotte, and it's our only chance.
Please, Mr. Mallory, we can't have any noise in the room.
Simmons, go ahead with the nails. Don't make any more noise than it's necessary.
I won't, sir.
Oh, Walter, why must you do this?
I just told you, my dear. We're trying an experiment. Mr. Edison thinks it will work, and I do, too.
There you are, sir.
All right, Simmons. Now let's get that cake of ice.
Right. Walter, are you mad?
No, dear. Will you please just trust in me?
Yes, of course I will.
All right, then. Wait until I fix this thing. And how's that, son? Is the box steady now?
Well, it's as steady as I can make it, Mr. Mallory, without making too much noise.
All right, then. Come and help me.
Yes, sir.
Mrs. Mallory.
Now, nurse, don't be alarmed. I know my husband is trying this experiment for Charlotte's good. It's one of Mr. Edison's ideas, you know.
Yes, Mrs. Mallory, I know. But I don't know what the doctor would say.
Well, we'll just have to wait and see what happens.
Yes, I suppose so. But I won't be responsible.
Don't let it slip. Easy now, Simmons. All right, now. Up. Lift it up. Up into the box.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Don't make any more noise than you can help when you put it down now.
No, sir.
Look out for your fingers.
All right. Now, here we go.
There. That's it. Now then, you wire up the electric pan while I close the other windows.
Oh, Mr. Mallory, please, don't close the other windows, sir. Your daughter needs all the air she can get.
Yes, nurse, I know that. What I'm doing is for the best. There now. Now this one.
Mr. Mallory, pardon me, sir, but I must protest. I cannot allow you to leave those windows shut.
Don't worry, nurse. It's all a part of our experiment. Now, I'm just going to close this window a bit. It's opposite the one that box is sitting. I'm going to leave it open about this much. There. That's about right.
Oh, Walter, you can't do this. You're shutting out all the air.
Please, dear, now, just a moment. How about it, Simmons? The pan running?
It will be, sir, when I turn it on.
All right.
Here we are.
Wait now. Let's see what happens. I want to watch this thermometer.
Walter, is that cool air I feel?
Yes, I think it is. But we'll have to wait and see.
Mr. Mallory, the room is cooler. There's a draft of cold air blowing in from the window. I can feel it.
And so can I. But I want to see if this thermometer will go down.
Wait. Why, she's rousing. Charlotte is stirring. I never expected she would.
But, Walter, I don't understand.
You see, dear, the fan draws the air into the room, and the ice cools it. It's just a makeshift device, but at least it will keep the room cooler than outside. And that ought to help Charlotte get well.
Edison's crude air-cooling device helped bring Mallory's daughter out of danger. But it was another matter to get her well again. She did not rally. Her convalescence was discouragingly slow. When Edison heard this, he paid Charlotte a visit. In the hall outside of her room, Edison and Mallory meet the doctor.
How do you do, Mr. Edison?
Well, doctor, how's your patient today, doctor?
About the same, Mr. Edison. I must say the delay in her recovery is disheartening.
Is there anything I can possibly do?
No, Mr. Mallory, I'm afraid not.
Don't you know of anything that would do her any good?
Oh, yes. A change of scene would do wonders for her. Just the kind of a tonic she needs. She's too weak. I don't dare risk moving.
Is there any medical tonic that will do the work?
I'm giving her what I can, but it isn't entirely a matter of medicines. It's a matter of cooperation from her own tired little body. She needs normal acceleration of the glands and impulses. A natural quickening of the nervous system that would come from the stimulus she'd get from new surroundings.
But you say she can't be moved.
Yes, that unfortunately is our dilemma.
Well, there must be some way out.
Well, if there is, Mr. Edison, I'm sure you could find it.
Doctor, I've invented a slight improvement for my window box. You mind if I experiment with it?
Go right ahead, Mr. Edison. I believe Charlotte can bear the noise now.
I won't make any noise. My improvement is chemical, not physical, Doctor. We'll leave the physical improvement to Charlotte.
Very well. Will you excuse me? I have several other calls to make. Then I'll be back.
Well, of course, Doctor.
Goodbye. 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 Goodbye, Doctor.
Well, Mr. Edison, Charlotte will be glad to see you.
We could only get her happy and well again, Mallory. How's Mrs. Mallory bearing up?
Well, she's resting. We'll find a nurse in charge. If you don't mind, I'll go in first.
Right ahead.
Is that you, Daddy?
Yes, Lottie, and I brought your best bow with me.
Is Mr. Edison here? Oh, I'm so glad.
Hello, Charlotte. Doctor tells me you ought to take a trip somewhere. Make you strong and well again.
Oh, I do wish so I could, but they won't let me.
Well, how'd you like to go on a trip with me? Just a little trip, sort of a picnic.
Oh, I'd love to.
Please don't excite her, Mr. Edison.
Nurse, the doctor said she needed some natural stimulation.
Yes, but not the depression that comes from disappointment.
The nurse is right, Mr. Edison.
Well, perhaps Charlotte won't be disappointed.
Yes, but there's a risk.
With more to gain than to lose. But if I haven't your permission, then of course I won't try my idea.
Well, no, go ahead if you think it's all right. I have perfect confidence in you, sir.
But Mr. Mallory...
I'll take the responsibility, nurse. Mr. Edison has an improvement on his window air box he wants to try. It may help Charlotte.
Very well. But if I see any bad effects from it on the patient, you'll have to stop at once.
Of course.
When do you think I could go on a picnic with you, Mr. Edison?
Don't you think the best thing about a picnic is the fun of knowing you're outdoors under the trees, with the cool air blowing over fields of fresh clover and flowers?
Yes. Oh, when can we go?
Why, I think we can go right now.
Now? Why, they won't let me leave this room, not even this bed.
We won't let that stop us from having fun. If we can't go out to the picnic, we'll bring the picnic in here.
But it won't be the same.
It'll be even better. You can have your choice for your picnic today. Where'll it be? Under some shade trees at the edge of a field with a brook? On a sandy beach down by the seashore? Or on the side of a mountain with a fine view and tall pine trees all around?
Oh, the mountains. With the wind going through the pines and making sort of music.
All right, then. The mountains it is. Excuse me, Mallory. Let me at that window box.
Why, of course. Now look, nurse. Look how her eyes have brightened.
Her pulse has quickened, too. You must be careful. A serious reaction might hurt her.
How can you bring the mountains in here, Mr. Edison? The trees I want are much too high for in here.
Well, we'll see what we can do, Charlotte.
Just pretend?
Well, a little more than that. Try now. Can you close your eyes and imagine big, tall pine trees?
Why, I can almost smell them.
Why, that's funny. I could swear I smell them, too.
Now we'll get the fire started to cook supper with.
I smell something burning.
Of course you do, nurse. That's the fine dry wood Charlotte and I have gathered for our picnic fire.
Oh, you make it all seem so real. I can smell the smoke and the old dead leaves and pine trees. I know I can. It's just exactly like it. Are you any good with a frying pan, Mr. Edison?
No. I always start experimenting with whatever's in it to spoil it.
Well, I can cook. You'd better let me do it.
All right. Say, I smell the woods. It's wonderful.
Well, I'm a practical woman myself, but either I smell the woods too, or else you're a spellbinder, Mr. Edison. Ought to be tried for witchcraft.
They used to call him the Wizard of Menlo Park.
There's no magic in this. It's just chemistry.
Well, all chemistry's magic to me.
Most of the smells in nature can be duplicated in a chemical laboratory.
But this isn't a laboratory.
I got several little bottles here. I brought them with me. Each has a picnic in it.
Oh, goody. More picnics.
Oh, I see, Mr. Edison. You just pour some fluid in front of the pan in the window box, and it fills the room with the same air you smell in the woods or the seashore or wherever you want to be.
Exactly.
Well, it's just like the real thing, except for the scenery.
And the ants.
Mr. Edison, what shall I do with this lime juice I've got to take?
We'll squeeze it over that fine fresh trout after you've cooked it.
That'll taste good.
Yes, at least the limes are real.
And so is the improvement in Charlotte.
Your experiment has been a great success, Mr. Edison.
You have a great mind, Mr. Edison.
But it isn't half as great as his heart, nurse. It wasn't his genius that did this. It was his love. Thank you.
Aided by Mr. Edison's cooling contrivance and by his chemical picnics, Charlotte Mallory recovered from her illness. She grew up to be a fine young lady, one of the hundreds who knew Edison personally, who admired and respected and loved him. One of the greatest tributes to his memory is the Thomas Alva Edison Foundation, established to aid worthy students by those who knew and worked with him. The whole world has honored Edison for his inventive genius. This evening, we are proud to salute Thomas Alva Edison, the man, as DuPont adds his name to the cavalcade of America. Remember the old wheeze, everybody talks about the weather, but nobody does anything about it. Well, that's not true anymore. Modern chemistry has done a lot about weather. A chemist puts it this way.
When you think of air conditioning, you think of cool comfort, regardless of outside temperatures. Chemistry contributes the ingredient that makes things cool. It's called a refrigerant, and DuPont produces a number of types, including several widely used for cooling and ice making. You know how these products of chemistry serve you in air-conditioned movies, stores, and restaurants, but industry has put them to work in unusual places. For example,
far down in the Robinson Deep Gold Mine, South Africa, normal temperatures hover around 120 degrees, and the humidity makes this heat almost unbearable. But now the mine shaft has been air-conditioned, and the miners keep cool and comfortable 8,300 feet below the surface. The same is true in the Magma Copper Mine at Superior, Arizona, where air cooling plants are at work nearly three-quarters of a mile down. And on the Syrian Desert, a new streamlined bus of glittering stainless steel made in Philadelphia by the Bud Manufacturing Company flashes 65 miles an hour along the sandy 600-mile run from Baghdad to Damascus as brown-skinned natives stare in astonishment. Its 14 passengers ride and sleep in comfort, despite temperatures that may vary from 0 to 140 degrees above. For this new Desert Express is air-conditioned. A DuPont refrigerant is used. And underwater, in submarines, DuPont refrigerants are at work in equipment that actually manufactures air for the men who work under the sea. Ocean liners now offer air-conditioned comfort for their passengers, too, while many steamers bringing fruit from the tropics protect their cargoes en route with air cooling that provides even coolness in all parts of the ship's hold. Now, how about air conditioning for you and me this summer?
These chemical refrigerants keep you comfortable not only in movies, restaurants, stores, and hotels, but work for you almost everywhere. Today, all major trains in the United States are partly or completely air conditioned, with railroads installing equipment at the rate of 1,500 cars a year. Industries are using it increasingly where control of temperature and humidity is essential. Now, lower-cost room units are available for home and office, while air conditioning probably serves humanity best of all in the operating rooms of hospitals.
Yes, it's certainly true that DuPont chemists, working with air conditioning engineers, help guard our health and comfort against summer's high temperatures and humidity. This work is one more illustration of how DuPont is making good its pledge. Better things for better living through chemistry. Of the American Indian, the music and customs of primitive America will be the subject of our broadcast when next week at the same time DuPont again presents the Cavalcade of America. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
All right, folks, that was the Cavalcade of America and Thomas Edison. Or should I say 1898 Thomas Edison. What an innovative person he was. You'll really agree. You'll also realize and wonder that maybe this man was lucky. At least in a series that shows that it was maybe a matter of luck. Yes, indeed. Here is A Matter of Luck. And the episode is entitled Thomas, Alva Edison, and Alexandro Volta. Enjoy the show.
A Matter of Luck. A program dedicated to the greatest inventor and scientific discoverer the world has known, Lady Luck. And bringing you in one complete 30-minute presentation, two authentic and true stories of remarkable scientific achievement. Tonight, we tell you of Thomas Alva Edison and Alessandro Volta, and how each became famous through A Matter of Luck. Thomas Alva Edison and A Matter of Luck. The name of Thomas Alva Edison will go down in history as that of a man who had possibly the most inventive mind of the 19th century. A man whose industry and talents were sufficient to solve almost any problem put to him. And yet, the invention for which he is most famous owes its birth to a matter of luck. From his earliest years, Edison had shown more than ordinary intelligence, not so much in the fields of science and invention as in business. But while he was still a youth, a chance accident altered the course of his life. He lived with his parents at Port Huron in Michigan, not far from Detroit, and one day he was walking near the train tracks.
What does that little girl think she's doing? Hey, little girl, keep away from the line, there's a train coming. Hey, keep away, hey there. But get away, you'll be run over. Look out for the train! Look out!
Ooh, that was close. Too close for me. Young lady, you are the luckiest and the silliest girl in Michigan. Now, what's your name, eh? Oh, you won't talk, eh? Well, it doesn't matter. I know you. You're the station master's little daughter. Now, come along. I'm going to take you home.
Man, I'll never be able to thank you enough. If there's ever anything I can do to repay you for saving my daughter's life...
Well, sir, there is one thing you could do.
Well, speak up, then. Anything that's in my power...
Well, I've always wanted to see how the railway telegraph system works. You see, I'm rather interested in that kind of thing.
You are, eh? Well, just you come round to the station tomorrow and I'll show you all you'll ever want to know about it. Why, if you're that keen, I might even get you a job as an operator.
Would you do that, sir? Would you really?
Well, just you come round in the morning and we'll see.
And so Thomas Edison started work with the Grand Trunk Railroad as a telegraph operator. But the novelty of night duty soon wore off, and for the first time in his life, Edison turned to inventing.
The railroad company had a rule that night operators were required to give a prescribed Morse signal every hour to indicate that they were awake. But Edison thought differently.
Oh, I'm darned if I'm going to stay awake all night for two or three messages that will wake me up when they come through anyway. Oh, let me think. Yes, that'll do it. That'll send the hourly signal through. Yes, that'll do it perfectly.
Edison built his first gadget, a contrivance that worked from the station clock and sent the necessary signal for him. But one night...
Hey there! You in there! Wake up! Wake up!
All right. All right, I'm coming. What's the matter?
You're supposed to stay awake on the job. The company doesn't pay you to sleep all night. If it wasn't that I got you the job... Uh-huh, what's this? Well, what do you know? Fix the clock and a couple of magnets to send your signal in for you, eh? Very clever.
Well, I didn't think it'd do any harm. I always wake up for signals, you know that.
If you're clever enough to think up a thing like this, you're wasting your time working here. Yes, sir. So, from now on, you don't. Get me?
Edison was soon looking for other worlds to conquer. He traveled about the United States studying and gaining invaluable experience, and by 1869, when he was 22, he was on the threshold of his career. He arrived in New York when that city was in the throes of a wild speculation in gold. 600 Wall Street brokers received their market prices by wire from the Gold Reporting Company. At the height of one day's furious trading, the ticker machines broke down at the company's headquarters, and by the merest chance, young Edison was nearby. He knew how the machines worked, and he seized the opportunity.
Where will I find the president of this company?
In the door there, but he's too busy to see anyone now.
He'll see me. I can fix the ticker machines. Can you spare me a minute, sir?
Confound it, no. Get out of my way. Laker. Laker, you fool. Can't you get the engineers here?
But, Dr. Laws, you don't want the engineers. You want me.
So I don't, eh? 600 brokers on my neck. The market crashing. My machine's not operating, and I have to listen to you. Get out. I'm ruined.
Now, just a minute, sir. I can fix your machine.
I said get out.
All right, if you want to be ruined.
Hey, just a minute. Can you really fix these things?
Yes, sir. I can't.
Then get your coat off and start work. But I warn you, if you're fooling, I'll have you thrown in the Hudson River. And these infernal ticker machines after you.
Thomas Edison repaired the machines and averted a stock market debacle. And his fortune was made. We see him next set up in a workshop and laboratory in New Jersey, with a staff of mechanics and technicians whose task was to improve telegraphy and communications generally. One invention after another flowed from his fertile brain. His were the brilliant inspirations, and the working models were made by the chief of his mechanics, a Swiss named Krusi. Then came a demand for a machine to record telegrams and retransmit them at three times the speed. And from this sprang Edison's most famous invention. The machine was soon designed, and Edison explained to Krusi, the mechanic, who was to build the first working model.
Now, see here, Krusi. I've thought it all out, and here's the first rough drawings of it.
A recorder and transmitter.
Yes. Now, this is how it works. A needle will press on this circular disc of wax board as it revolves at a certain speed.
Yeah.
Say, 50 revolutions a minute.
Yeah.
You see?
Yeah, I see.
As the message comes in over the wire, the needle will press down. Mm. A short press for a dot, a long press for a dash. Yeah. Thus scratching an impression of the dots and dashes in the wax on the disc.
That's very good, Mr. Edison. Very good.
Now, to transmit at a higher speed than we received, we simply let the pressed disc rotate faster under another needle. This needle follows the dots and dashes and will send out the message almost as fast as we like.
Yeah, I see that. Very good. You want me to work on it now?
Yeah, right away.
Soon the recorder was built, but certain modifications were necessary. One night, Edison was asleep in the workshop after a hard day
with Prusy working on the machine in another room, when an extraordinary occurrence took place.
Mr. Edison. Wake up, Mr. Edison. Wake up.
What is it?
Wake up and come quickly. Something I do not understand. Quickly.
What are you talking about?
The recording machine. It makes noises. It makes noises like a woman. It screams.
You've gone mad.
Come, see for yourself if I am mad. It is the machine that has gone mad. The recording machine.
Oh, all right. But I wish you'd left me asleep.
Now then, Mr. Edison. I started going, yes?
Yes, turn it on. Turn it off. I can't stand that noise.
There. What manner of machine have we made?
I don't know, Crucy. It's darned interesting. Now, let's have a look. First of all, the governor that controls the speed of the disk isn't working. So it runs at about 10 times too fast. Yeah, that's the first thing.
But what is it that makes the noise?
Well, this disk has been impressed with dots and dashes. And the needle runs over them at a very high speed.
Yeah.
The needle is agitated violently hundreds of times a second, and the noise results. Crucy. This gives me an idea.
Thomas Edison did not sleep that night, for the stroke of luck in the faulty recorder had shown him how to make a device such as the world had never seen. He sat until dawn with drawing board and pencils, and when the mechanic Crucy reported for work, the design was ready.
About this idea of yours last night.
Now sit down and listen, Crucy. This new machine is going to set the world by the ears. Now, first of all, here's what you do. You take a brass cylinder about 8 inches long and 3 in diameter.
Yeah?
The exact size doesn't matter. Mm. And cut a narrow spiral groove in it from one end to another.
Like the thread of a screw?
Yes, but shallower and finer. Say, 50 to the inch.
Yeah?
Then mount it on an axle that can be turned by a crank handle. Got that?
Yeah, I have got it, but...
Then build this membrane and needle attachment I've drawn here, just as you see it in the drawing.
Yeah, but... What is this thing? What does it do?
I'll tell you all that in good time.
Soon, the apparatus was built and ready. And Edison gathered what he hoped were to be the first people in the world to hear his remarkable demonstration. Engineers and staff gathered round, none with the slightest inkling of what they were about to witness.
You will all have to be perfectly quiet, gentlemen. Not a sound, please. Crucy, turn the crank slowly.
Yeah.
I shall speak into this tin horn while Crucy cranks. Well, here we go. Mary had a little lamb. Its fleece was white as snow. And everywhere that Mary went... The lamb was sure to go. Now hold your breaths, everyone. Crucy, put the needle back to the start and turn again at the same speed.
Yeah.
Mary had a little lamb. Its fleece was white as snow. And everywhere that Mary went... The lamb was sure to go.
Oh, wow.
But upon my soul, the thing talked. I heard it.
That, gentlemen, was an instrument I have decided to call the phonograph, meaning the writing of the voice. And I can tell you that never in my whole life have I experienced such a thrill. I have registered the human voice and reproduced it for the first time in history.
And so, a few days before Christmas of 1876, the phonograph was born. The instrument that has brought the world's music and the voices of the world's artists to millions of people in every country on earth. But until Thomas Edison's telegraph recording machine made its scratchy wailing through chance and a fault in its mechanism, the idea of the phonograph had never entered his head, and possibly never would have. So it is true to say that the invention of the phonograph and the gramophones and radiograms that derive from it was not a matter of intent. No, indeed, it was merely a matter of luck.
In just 1 minute, we shall tell you another fascinating true story, that of Alessandro Volta. At the moment, we pause for a word from our announcer.
Back now to our narrator and cast for the second unusual but true story in our program, A Matter of Luck. Alessandro Volta and A Matter of Luck. One evening in 1790, a professor of medicine was lecturing to his pupils in his home at Bologna in Italy. On this occasion, which was to be of such importance in the history of natural science, the professor and his listeners were in the chief room of the house, which, in accordance with the custom of the day, was drawing room, lecture room, bedroom, and kitchen in one. So that while the professor lectured on one side, his good wife prepared the evening meal on the other. His name was Aloisio Galvani, and on this particular evening, his wife was skinning frogs for supper with the steel scalpel he normally used for dissections and surgery. Unhygienic, but true.
Oh, my poor Aloisio. You love your frog's legs for supper, but the work you make for me. Donna Maria, here is a fat one. Come, little fat frog, off with your skin. So, we peel a little here, and a little there. Ow! Oh!
What is this, Signora? You have cut yourself with a scalpel, yes?
Aloisio, I have been skinning a live frog.
A live one? Oh, so the butcher boy plays a little joke, eh? He sells us a live frog among the dead ones, the better to scare the Signora. Ha!
Now, silence, silence!
This is no laughing matter, gentlemen. Now, my dear, which is the live frog?
This one that is half-skinned.
But, my dear, no frog could be deader. See?
It was alive a minute ago. It nearly jumped off the platter.
My dear, you must be mistaken. This frog is not only dead, but has been for some time. Here, try it for yourself.
I don't care, Aloisio. I don't care what it smells like. It jumped and it twisted. I saw it.
Show me. Let me see it move a muscle.
But now it will not move. It won't move at all. But, Aloisio, I swear by all the saints it did. Twice before.
Show me exactly what you did before. Exactly.
Well, I laid it on the plate. Thus. And placed the scalpel. Thus. And skinned it. There, see?
Well, upon my soul, woman, move it did. What devil's work is this, or have we made a discovery? The tin plate, steel scalpel. Wife, I have it. I've discovered the primary source of life. Animal electricity. Animal electricity, that's what it is. I cannot wait. I must go at once to the university. Oh, what a discovery I've made. What a miracle.
Aloisio Galvani rushed post-haste to the university to spread the news of his remarkable discovery, concealing the fact that it was his wife's discovery anyway. There he commenced a series of experiments designed to throw more light on the nature of this newly discovered phenomenon. Soon it became known as galvanism, and scientists gathered from all over Italy to hear Signor Galvani tell his tale of the twitching frog's leg and the deduction he had so cleverly drawn from it. Among these was a professor of physics from the University of Pavia, Alessandro Volta, a man of great intelligence and resource. He was intrigued by Galvani's discovery, and at the first opportunity went to his house at Bologna to hear at first hand exactly what had happened.
Your name, sir? I did not catch your name.
Alessandro Volta, signor, at your service.
Volta? Volta? No, I cannot say I've heard the name. However, pray come in. I may be able to spare you a few moments.
Oh, you are too kind, signor. And I shall take as little of your time as possible.
You are a scientist?
Well, yes. Though, of course, not of your eminence. I am from the University of Pavia, where I lecture in physics.
Ah, yes, of course, Pavia. We have surpassed you here in Bologna these last few months, eh, Volta? Eh?
Oh, undoubtedly. We have not men of your caliber, nor men of your great, shall we say, intuition. I am referring to your discovery of animal electricity.
We are using the expression galvanism at the present, in a manner of speaking. A compliment to me.
I beg your pardon. Galvanism, by all means. Now, senor, I am here to learn. What can you tell me about it?
You must be behind the times at Pavia. Further behind than I thought. It is quite obvious that I discovered the prime source of life, the force that distinguishes living creatures from the dust.
Quite so. But how did you come to this conclusion?
Oh, I saw the truth at once. The moment the frog's leg moved.
Upon what? Upon what was the frog's leg resting?
Oh, what does it matter? That has nothing to do with it.
Oh, quite so, quite so. Merely idle curiosity. Pray go on.
Oh, very well, very well. The frog's leg twitched, and I said to myself, Aloisio Galvani, under what compulsion does that dead creature move? You know the answer, Signor Volta?
Yes. Animal electricity.
Really, Professor Volta? Galvanism!
Oh, 1,000 pardons. So that is the story. You saw the frog's leg move. You know it was dead, so you saw the answer immediately.
That is so, Signor.
And knowing that in all human experience, dead creatures did not move.
I am the discoverer of the life force.
Well, that is extremely interesting. Now I must not presume further on your kindness. But before I go, what was the frog resting on? A table? Upon pottery? Earthenware?
It was resting on a tin plate.
Ah, a tin plate. And did anything else touch it? A hand? Perhaps a knife? A fork?
My wife was skinning its leg with a steel scalpel. Now I must ask you to excuse me, Signor. I'm very, very busy these days, and I hope my work will help you here in Pavia.
Your work won't help, my friend. But maybe the discovery you stumbled on will.
Back in Pavia, Alessandro Volta set out on his own account to find why a frog's muscles should twitch as they had done for Galvani. Although he was convinced that Galvani was both stupid and vain to jump at so ridiculous an explanation without a moment's thought. Volta duplicated the conditions in Signora Galvani's kitchen with the tin plate, the steel scalpel, the frog's flayed thigh, and exactly the same twitchings took place. But Volta then went a step further with a bold theory. He reasoned that the frog played a very minor part in the phenomenon, and that some other agency was at work. But his friend Giuseppe was becoming impatient and did not hesitate to say so.
My good friend, how much longer are you going to potter and stoop over this problem? I am beginning to think that old Del Galvani was a fraud, that the frogs were alive all the time.
Ah, no, Giuseppe. We cannot believe that. We have demonstrated too often and before too many witnesses.
Then if the frogs were not bewitched and Galvani is wrong, what is the truth about it?
I think I know. But first, I must test my theory. Now, Giuseppe, you have seen the frogs jump when the scalpel touches them.
Yes.
And you think it is from some force coming from the dead frogs.
Of course, that is obvious.
Well, I do not agree. I think this, that whenever moisture comes between two different metals, an electric potential is produced, and the frog therefore merely acted as a conductor between the metal plate and the metal scalpel. If I am right, Giuseppe, imagine what would happen if you connected together hundreds of metal plates with hundreds of frogs and hundreds of scalpels.
I can imagine, with hundreds of frogs in the room.
If I am right, if my theory is right, we would have an electric storehouse that we could tap at will. Now I am going to start experimenting at once, using every combination of every metal known. And you can help.
I can? How?
Out you go, and don't come back until you have a bucket containing 100 frogs.
Walter's experiments have gone down in history, and he has given his name to the unit of electromotive force, the Vault. But before the story is ended, there was still another encounter with Galvani.
Ah, Signor Walter, I have traveled all the way from Bologna to pick a bone with you.
Oh, indeed. Well, first come in and sit down.
Yes.
Now then, what have I done to offend you?
You have stolen my discovery. I have heard about you and your experiments.
Good. Then I need not tell you the results of them.
On the contrary, I insist on hearing, so that I may take proper steps to have you dealt with.
As you please. Now, first of all, I have proved your animal electricity story quite wrong.
Prove me wrong? Prove me wrong, you say?
Yes. The frog's legs had almost nothing to do with the force you found. It was caused by moisture between two different metals.
Ha! Nonsense. It's a farrago of nonsense.
Then examine at your leisure this contrivance I have built. It is the first source of electric current the world has seen. And, in deference to you, I have named it the galvanic element.
That is only just.
But that is not what my friends insist on calling it.
Indeed.
No. Some of them have named it the voltaic pile in my honor, while others, and I prefer this name, have called it the electric battery.
From the lucky accident in Signora Galvani's kitchen came the electric battery, or voltaic pile. For many years, the only source of electric current known to man, and still in use today in 1,001 different ways. For Walter, it was but a single step from his discovery of the true nature of Galvani's force to its utilization, making the battery, with which electrical engineering began its conquest of the world. As for Galvani, he was still proclaiming his opinion when he died in 1798 that he had found the life force. So his name has come down to us even though he did not deserve his fame. But Walter's electric battery came about by a matter of luck. Walter had never dreamed of a battery and did not know the principle upon which one could work until Galvani's wife touched the leg of a dead frog lying on a tin plate and made it jump. Surely no matter of intent, just a matter of luck. Thank you.
The two authentic stories of the discovery of the phonograph and the electric battery were dramatized by Lindsay Hardy from Factual Research Material and were directed by Donovan Joyce. The performers included Richard Ashley, Douglas Herold, Alan Trevor, Reginald Collins, Norman Blackler, Billy Lockwood, David McGoffin, and David Lowe. Your narrator was Ward Leopold, who invites you to listen again 1 week from now, same night, time, and station, for a further fascinating half hour of A Matter of Luck, a Donovan Joyce production.
Well, folks, that was A Matter of Luck, and Thomas Alva Edison and Alexandro Volta. Did you enjoy this hour of interest, sentimental thinking and doing, as well as intrigue, sneakiness, cleverness, and what have you? I know I did. I really enjoy Cavalcade of America, and I think they make things a bit more sentimental than real. But who needs truth if it's dull, in my opinion? Ah, yes. We need to go now, friends. You know why? Because we have to usher in our insulating person. He's the person that will let us talk until all hours of the night. This man of mystery, or maybe I'll just call him the man of luck just for fun. Louise. Louise, my friend, close out the show so we can all chatter, chatter, chatter. And before I let you take the mic, Louise, I wish everybody peace and a good summer. Now, Louise, here you go.
Okay, Mad Max, thanks a lot. I think I'll take it from here. Besides, I don't think that these people have any gas. But anyway, folks, it is that time again when I have to step in and do what I do best, and that is shut things down and wrap things up for this week's broadcast of Michael's Saturday Night Surprise. But don't worry, we will be back again. As usual, folks, if you have any questions, comments, complaints, or maybe even a request or two, please address them to the MSS director. He can be found at michaemelli@earthlink.net. That's MIKEAMELI@earthlink.net. We will soon be releasing the key and returning the room to you, the listening audience. Please do with it as you wish, for as long as you wish. But just remember, be nice to one another. On behalf of myself and the rest of the MSS crew, have a great night, a great weekend. Keep on enjoying the summer. Bye.